All right, the reason that all of you are here tonight is because you care about our environment, you care about climate change, and I'm absolutely certain of this, most of you are worried. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of fear. In fact, I don't think there's ever been an election, certainly in my lifetime, maybe in this country, that has evoked so much fundamental and widespread fear and anxiety than the election results from November 8th. I really, after I got over my own denial and shock at the results, wanted to believe maybe I was wrong. That maybe Donald Trump, you know, this is a big job, there's so much seriousness, that maybe the weight of responsibility on this man would cause him to reflect and to go to a deeper, more serious place and think about the bigger picture, the rest of the world. And on this issue of climate change in particular and environmental protection, maybe that would be part of governing in a better way than he campaigned, in a better way than, frankly, he's lived a lot of his life. Unfortunately, any hopes in that regard, hopes that came when you heard that he was meeting with Al Gore, hopes when in one meeting he suggested his previous statement on climate change that it was a Chinese hoax, that maybe he'd have an open mind when he met with the New York Times editorial board. Well, a lot of cold water has been thrown on those hopes in the last few weeks by virtue of the terrible appointments that he has made. He is surrounding himself with some people that are climate deniers and absolute environmental wrecking balls. And so we've gone from perhaps a little bit of wishful thinking to a pretty grim reality. And now I think we need to go to a new place, and that is a place of action. We need to get ready for what is coming our way. So let's start with what we already know. We know that as a candidate, Donald Trump said he believes climate change is a hoax. We know that he made wild promises in Appalachia, in the Midwest, about bringing back the coal industry and jobs from fossil fuel extraction. We know that he's promised to pull the United States out of the Paris Climate Accord. And we know that he's promised to eliminate all sorts of regulations that he believes are holding back the economy. In fact, he didn't really have an environmental section on his webpage like most candidates. He talked about getting rid of regulations, and he said, sort of by the way, we're going to have great clean air and great clean water, but we're going to get rid of all these regulations. Well, those regulations in many cases are what give us the clean air and the clean water. So there's a lot to worry about in that regard, and those worries are underscored by the people he's appointed so far. So specifically, you know many of these. For the Environmental Protection Agency, he's chosen an attorney general in Oklahoma, Scott Pruitt, whose own biography on his official webpage describes himself as a leading advocate against the EPA's activist agenda. Tells you a lot about Scott Pruitt. He is currently suing the EPA over President Obama's Clean Power Plan. He is a leading ally of the fossil fuel industry, so much so that he's actually been caught allowing oil companies to write official letters for him that he turned around and put on his own letterhead as Oklahoma Attorney General and sent to the EPA. So this is a guy who's pretty darn close to the fossil fuel industry, and he is a climate denier. For the Department of Energy, President-elect Trump has chosen Rick Perry. Now, bear in mind that the Department of Energy is responsible for some of the most important research and development in the world on energy efficiency, on renewable and alternative energy technologies. It is the place that oversees nuclear non-proliferation, and also our national laboratories like Lawrence Berkeley and Lawrence Livermore. Past secretaries of energy have included people like our current secretary, Ernie Moniz, who is a PhD in nuclear physics, nuclear physicist. Before him, it was Dr. Stephen Chu, who was a Nobel laureate. Before him, now under George W. Bush, I didn't agree with his policies, but at least he chose an MIT professor, Sam Bodman, to be his Secretary of Energy. Rick Perry was a cheerleader at Texas A&M. But he is also a paid board director for Texas-based Energy Transfer Partners.
Yeah, wonderful.
That may sound familiar to you because that is the company that is pushing the Dakota Access Pipeline. He's now going to be Secretary of Energy. Perry is on record saying that he would eliminate the Department of Energy. And I think I had one more thing to say about Rick Perry, but I can't remember it. So, just moving to a couple more of these appointments. At the Department of Interior, we've got Montana Congressman Ryan Zinke. Now, I'm going to be a little nicer about Ryan Zinke. I served with him on the Natural Resources Committee. He's a nice guy, and I'm going to give him some points for showing courage, actually standing up to his own caucus to defend the Land and Water Conservation Fund, which is really an important thing for those of us that care about our public places and our parks. But he will also, as Secretary of Interior, be in charge of leasing for energy projects on public lands. And this is where he's a very worrying pick, because he believes we should open it pretty wide open to coal leasing and coal extraction. And in fact, he has fought to preserve coal royalty loopholes, which right now shortchange taxpayers by hundreds of millions of dollars every year, and are another form of subsidy that is propping up the obsolete coal industry. The last one I'll mention is the nominee for Secretary of State, the CEO of ExxonMobil, Rex Tillerson. This is a guy who has spent his entire career, this is his only foreign policy experience, he's spent his career roaming the world looking for oil and gas deals, sometimes against the interests of the United States of America. This is the perspective that he brings to the job of being our top diplomat. Now, all of these and a bunch of other appointments spell big trouble for our climate and for our environment. But there's actually other things to worry about and other things to watch. One of them is the status of the gains we've made under the Obama administration. There's a law that was brought to us as part of the contract with America under the Gingrich era called the Congressional Review Act. And what that does is it gives Congress a 60-day window, 60 legislative days, to look backward and override any final regulation. It's a really powerful tool, because when Congress does this, and they've hardly ever done it to date, but believe me, they're getting ready to do it. When they do it, it blocks that agency from doing anything substantively similar in that field. So it has a real freezing effect in that particular area. And in this case, there's some debate about exactly how far back the next Congress will be able to reach in terms of Obama administration regulations that could be overridden by the next Congress. But it takes us probably somewhere around June of 2016. And that means there are at least three pretty significant environmental rules that are going to be in the crosshairs. One of them involves landfill waste emissions that would help better capture and control methane gas emissions. Another is the Arctic drilling safety rule, which sets very rigorous safety standards. So oil companies who want to explore and drill in the Arctic Ocean have to meet the very highest standards. It makes it much less economical for them to do so. And then finally, fuel economy standards for medium and heavy duty vehicles would be within that Congressional Review Act window. So we're going to be looking very carefully for the first 60 days of this next Congress to see which of those they go after. That's what we're up against. Now let's talk about what we're doing, and also what we can do together in the next year. Starting right now, I'm actually trying to make the most of the weeks that we have left with President Obama and his team. One of the things that I've urged them to do to make it much, much harder for the incoming administration to do environmental harm is to exercise some authority they have under the Outer Continental Shelf Lands Act. This is a piece of legislation that deals with energy development and extraction off our shores. but it includes a one-way provision for a president to withdraw areas from energy development. And it doesn't give the next president the authority to put them back. So that's a great tool. And it's one that I'm urging President Obama to use, not just in the Mid-Atlantic, not just in the Arctic, but off our California coast and off the entire West Coast. Yeah. The only way that drilling could proceed if the president exercised that authority is for Congress to literally go in and pass a new law that gave him that authority. And that's complicated. That's where we can fight them. That's where we can use our, hopefully, a bit of a firewall in the United States Senate. And that will also take a lot of time. Time is going to be a common theme in our strategy to fight back against bad stuff under the Trump administration. The next thing that we need to focus on is that we're going to have to re-win some environmental victories. We've had some good ones in the last couple of years on a couple of projects that are going to help us keep known fossil fuel reserves in the ground. You know that I'm an author of a bill called the Keep It in the Ground Act, and it's a response to the overwhelming weight of science that says we've got to keep 80% of the known fossil fuel reserves in the ground if we're going to limit the potentially catastrophic effects of climate change. Well, we've won big victories on the Keystone XL pipeline and on the Dakota Access Pipeline in the last couple of years. But Dakota Access Pipeline is not dead. Even though the Army Corps of Engineers has withdrawn the permit under the Missouri River that they were going to utilize for this project, I told you Donald Trump's energy secretary is a paid board member for the company pushing that project. Donald Trump himself is an investor in Energy Transfer Partners. They're going to do everything they can to get that project back online. On Keystone XL, it's the same thing. And on both of these projects, I think the reason we got the outcome that we did was this amazing, sustained grassroots movement that completely changed the politics of those two projects. We're going to need that, and then some, and the lawyers, but we're going to have to re-win those environmental victories in the months and years ahead. And then we're going to have to fight to hang on to the Clean Power Plan, which is really the crowning achievement of this administration when it comes to climate change. It is currently pending before the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals. They've had oral argument. Most people expect that we will get a final ruling on that in the spring. Probably one of our litigators can tell us whether there's a silver lining to Merrick Garland not getting on the Supreme Court. I don't know if he'll be able to participate in that decision or not, but he'll be back in the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals. And if we can win that case, that's also going to buy us a lot of time, because it means that that regulation is final, it's been upheld by the courts, and it'll be appealed to the Supreme Court. But during that whole period, the incoming Trump administration can't kill the Clean Power Plan. They can stop defending it. They can tell the lawyers to stand down. But the good news is we have environmental organizations and even states and others who have been granted intervener status, and they can continue to defend the rule in court even if the federal agencies try to leave the litigation. All of that is going to buy us a lot of time, and even at the end of the day, if we lose that particular rule, at the end of the day, if the Trump administration tries to pass a new rule to supersede the Clean Power Plan, it takes them a long time to do that, and it's going to be subject to all sorts of legal challenge. So time should work as an important strategic tool for us in trying to hang on to the Clean Power Plan. And then finally, with the Paris Accord, time is also a tool that we'll need to use. Trump has said he wants to pull out of it. It takes three more years to pull out of the Paris Accord under the terms of the accord itself. And one thing he could do to expedite that is to actually withdraw the United States from the underlying climate deal that gives us authority to participate in the Paris Accord. This gets a little bit complicated, but way back in the 1990s, under a guy named George Herbert Walker Bush, the United States entered into and ratified the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, negotiated in Rio de Janeiro. If Trump was to pull the United States out of that, that would have the effect of pulling us out of Paris as well, but it would be very controversial. It would be a terrible signal to the rest of the world. And the good news is the rest of the world is already working on ways to kind of hold the U.S. accountable. There's even been some talk about other countries imposing a carbon tariff on the United States if we were to take some of these extreme actions under the Trump administration. So stay tuned on that. When it comes to climate change, that's just my quick overview of some of the fights that lie ahead, some of the strategies. The last thing I'll mention in terms of endangered species protections, other important environmental laws, we are very lucky to live in California. Most people appreciate that healthy fish and wildlife are one of the many great reasons to call this place home, and we now have a supermajority in the California State Legislature. So what that means is that Democrats, working with the governor, can actually pass urgency legislation that takes effect immediately to backfill just about anything that the Trump administration and the next Congress may try to do to undermine California's environmental rules and safeguards. That's going to be a big deal for me as someone who works on water, because I just finished a pretty bruising battle back in Washington where the Republicans, in a very cynical move, took a bite out of the endangered species protections for fish in the Bay Delta. And they did it by overriding peer-reviewed biological opinions that are sort of the last line of defense against extinction for a couple of species, and then slipping that into a water infrastructure bill that had billions of dollars of projects in many members of Congress districts, and also had funding for the poor folks in Flint, Michigan, who desperately need our help. So they presented Democrats with a terrible choice, and they did all of this at the 11th hour, right as Congress was wrapping up its work and anxious to get home for the holidays. I lost that fight, and that's disappointing. But what's just as troubling is that I think that's one of the ways that the next Congress and this administration are going to be coming at us constantly, taking a bite out of the Endangered Species Act here, the Clean Water Act there, and then cynically pairing it with other things that people are going to want to vote for. So we're going to have to watch out for that, and we're going to have to use our backstop here in the state of California sometimes to move very quickly to move state protections in place to backfill for what we may be losing at the federal level. Okay, that's enough for me. I want to pass it over to these other folks for hopefully shorter comments than what I've just given you, and then we'll get right to your questions.
Thank you, Mr. Huffman. Thank you all for being here and giving us your time tonight. I'm Bruce Hurd, and I am the Program Director of the Climate Readiness Institute. This is a new institute, 2 years old, on campus at Berkeley. Our whole way of operating is to bring scientists, academics, together with practitioners from government, from nonprofits, from a wide variety of community groups to do climate adaptation research together, co-production, as it's called. It gets better research and it gets the research used, and this is what CRI is all about. We have about 10 projects going in the Bay Area right now that we're supporting on sea level rise, on heat and health, on carbon sequestration, a variety of topics, including some of those projects have a portion of them here in Marin County. And we're looking at health, we're concerned about infrastructure, we're concerned about ecosystems, all of the different impacts that climate change is having on the Bay Area and on California, which is our focus. So just a few observations, and I'm very interested to see your questions after the other talks. We're in big trouble. If you read the science, if you're reading just the science in the last 2-3 months, we're in bigger trouble by scientific studies than we were 6 months ago. The Arctic, the Antarctic, the heat waves, the extreme storms, we are starting to live in and going to live in a very different world. The question is really how different that world is going to be. That's what we have control over. The next 30 years are going to see emissions tracking along a path, and because of the built-in lag in the climate system, the built-in impacts are already in the system through mid-century. It's what happens after mid-century that we have control over. So we're going to have to, because we're in big trouble, we have to focus our efforts on big solutions. It's not going to get it anymore to be working on nice things that make us feel good. If they aren't big and they don't make a difference, we need to push them aside or let somebody else do them and take your time on things that are really going to make a difference, because that's as big as the stakes and the scale are. So I'm going to focus on a few things in California, because that's my expertise and that's where we live. And there are obviously lots of other things you can do nationally, but we'll talk first about California. I would focus on California, and I'm glad I get to because of our governor. How many people saw his AGU speech on YouTube yet? If you haven't seen it, look it up, it'll thrill you. It's a rough, not a stump speech. It's fabulous, and he is our leader in California. It's a great 15 minutes and well worth just Googling to look it up. We have AB 32 and SB 32 and SB 350 and SB 375 and the Padley Vehicle Standards. We have a whole set of laws and regulations, and we're on our way in California. We're having an impact and starting to turn the curve on emissions. But here are four or five things that we need to focus on as big solutions. The first is putting a price on carbon. We have the carbon cap and trade system here in California. You can debate, and people above my pay grade can debate tonight, a carbon tax versus cap and trade, but a price on carbon and a serious price on carbon is absolutely required, or we are dead in the water. Secondly, 100% electrification of the transportation system. In California, this has to be number one because it is our number one source of emissions in California. Transportation, I've worked in transportation before I came to the climate world 12 years ago. You can see it in Marin, you can see it in the Bay Area, it's about the vehicles. We can do wonderful things for public transit, but we better electrify the system. All of the cars in California, that's the only way we're going to get at that big chunk. The third on emissions reduction is short-lived climate pollutants, methane, black carbon, HFCs. These are increasingly getting attention at the state level. You can look up and see some of the state numbers that have been done because they'll get us more near-term results that we can actually see. It doesn't take away from CO2, which is the big target. But while we're doing that, we can buy ourselves some time by doing more short-term things where we'll see a result with these short-lived climate pollutants. Fourth, a greater emphasis on carbon sequestration, both in natural sequestration in rangelands, in forests, in wetlands, and more artificial. There's a lot of science going on right now on these artificial scrubbers that would pull CO2 out of the air. We're going to need all of that, folks. It's not enough to sit back and say that's giving up. We're going to need those kinds of solutions that are not here yet but are going to need to come, and we're going to need to put some juice and some emphasis behind them. One thing on the natural side, forests are a tremendous sequestration of vessel for carbon. But in California from 2000 to 2010, forests were a net emitter of carbon because of all the big forest fires. So we've got problems on our hands here in terms of building resilience in our natural lands so they can hold more carbon. And finally, the work that we work on at CRI, we've got to do more to make California number one in adaptation. California is number one, and deservedly so, on emissions reduction. I'm thankful every day that the governor and his staff have made that their priority. But we've got to turn the state's priority somewhat now to the adaptation world, because those impacts are coming. And we need to make California the national leader in adaptation in dealing with sea level rise and heat waves and health impacts and all of that, just like we've done with emissions reduction. So those are my observations. I'll still hold these for the discussion, but there's some things that we can do, like the under 2 MOU that we can talk about. We need a campaign to cultivate more leaders, more champions, like the one sitting next to me. We need champions badly for this in California. And finally, and maybe most importantly, this has got to engage youth. If it does not engage youth, again, we are dead in the water, and no bad pun intended. We've got to engage youth. That's what fuels these social movements that we need. Thank you very much.
think most of you came out for two reasons. One is, I want to thank you all for coming out tonight. And I suspect that many of you are here for two reasons. One is that you know that you have a congressman who is a leader in Washington in protecting the environment, not just here in California. But and the other is that you're concerned about what the election that happened 6 weeks ago means for the environment here in California and around the country. And you want to do something about it. And I'm going to go back to my office at Earth Justice tomorrow, and I'm going to tell my colleagues that on a Monday night in December, hundreds of people came out in San Rafael to talk about what we can all do working together in order to protect the environment.
Yes, the microphone.
Sorry. And they're going to be inspired to know that so many people are so ready to stand up. So I want to tell you about what we're doing at Earth Justice. My name is Drew Caputo, and I work at Earth Justice, which is an organization with 100 lawyers who file lawsuits against the government and industry in order to protect the environment. And we have offices from Alaska to Florida, from Hawaii to New York. And our motto is that we exist because the Earth needs a good lawyer. And the Earth has never needed a good lawyer more than it's going to need a good lawyer starting on January 20. Now, we have a lot of cases. To give you an example of what we do, we are proud to represent the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe. In their litigation to try and stop the Dakota Access Pipeline. And we've had a big victory recently when the Army Corps of Engineers decided not to grant the easement that they need in order to complete the pipeline to cross the Missouri River. But I have to tell you that when the Trump administration comes in, they're going to want to make a different decision. And we are going to do on that, in that case representing the Standing Rock Sioux, what we're going to do in all of the cases that are going to result from bad decisions in the new administration, which is America has very strong environmental laws. And America's court system allows people who care about the environment to go into court and challenge government decisions to make sure that they comply with the law. Because one of the things that matters about America is that no one is above the law. So what we're going to do with the support of you and others like you is to make sure that we're going to make sure that the government follows the law just like everyone else has to follow the law. Since the election, I and my colleagues at Earth Justice have been putting in place a three-part plan for responding. The first part is we're trying to do everything we can to get as much out of the Obama administration and help them run through the tape on January 20th. He's been an extraordinary president for the environment, and as Congressman Huffman mentioned, there's some additional things that he can do, and we're joining with the Congressman and others to try and accomplish things like permanent protection for the Arctic and the Pacific and the Atlantic Oceans from offshore oil drilling. That's stage one. Stage two is that we're preparing to fight in the first 100 days and beyond of the new Congress and the new administration by intervening in industry lawsuits against Obama administration protections, so that we can be in a position to block sweetheart deals once the Trump administration comes in, and have resources in place so that we can move to challenge adverse decisions. And our third step is that we are reorienting our advocacy in some ways, for example, away from things that are not achievable in the face of a hostile administration, and toward both playing defense and trying to accomplish what we can in other forums. One of the things that are going to be very important in the next 4 years are what we can accomplish in the states. It's going to be very difficult to accomplish positive environmental progress in Washington, D.C. We're going to be playing defense there for the most part. But it is going to be very possible to accomplish progress in places like Sacramento, and that's what we're going to do. So it's a pleasure to be with you tonight, and I look forward to helping to answer your questions.
Hi, I'm Michael Wall. I guess that's too close to the mic. I'm co-litigation director of the Natural Resource Defense Council in RDC. NRDC is a national nonprofit environmental organization, uses science, the law, to protect things, values we all believe in. Those values are under threat. Come January, many of the levers of government are going to be in the hands of truthers, which is kind of an odd term used for people who can't tell fact from fiction. And people with radical anti-environmental agenda. That threatens things that I'd like to think that all Americans believe in, and I know most of us do, that people have a right to a clean and healthy neighborhoods, that our natural heritage, our wild places and wild things, are things that should be preserved for our grandchildren and their grandchildren, that polluters should fix the problems that they cause, and that there is a difference between fact and fiction. You know, sometimes I wake up and I think, you know, you walk into the bookstore and there's the nonfiction section and the fiction section. I feel like some folks have just got in there and they've taken all the books and thrown them up in the air, and they're all scattered all over the floor, all mixed up and on the floor. And we need to fix that. So we have our work cut out for us, but I think we've seen this kind of thing before, maybe not quite as extreme, but this is not the first time. NRDC's been around an awful long time. And we have a staff of about 500 scientists, lawyers, and other professionals, and we're gearing up. You know, the day after the election, I came back to work with more focus and more determination than I've ever had. And I think that's the attitude people have. So we've mapped out the first 100 days what we expect to happen, and we're preparing for that. We are beefing up our litigation capacity, which is already robust. We are planning to fight in the halls of Congress, where the Senate still has a filibuster, and in the executive branch, where there are all these rules that President Obama put in place, previous presidents put in place, and Trump doesn't just rule by fiat. He's got to go through a process to repeal those rules. And that process gives an opportunity for the public, for you, for organizations like NRDC to provide input, to build a record, and ultimately to go to court. And so we're geared up for that. And in many ways, what's happened to our country is deeply discouraging. But from a purely professional perspective, I've got a lot of work to do over the next 4 years, and I'm very down to do it. So, we've heard Congressman Huffman told us about the appointees that the president-elect is naming, and there's a lot of targets out there. It's going to be a tough 4 years, but there's cause for hope. And I want to focus on that for a second. I think in some ways, there are many explanations for this election. It was decided by 80,000 votes in a few states. I mean, you could come up with many different causes for those 80,000 votes. But the American people did not vote against the environment. There's an overwhelming support in poll after poll for the values that we share. And we're going to be there to defend those values. The courts, as Drew mentioned, they're a very favorable place for us right now. The federal judiciary is largely not ideological. If you look at where most of the work gets done in the courts, it's done in the federal courts of appeals. The U.S. Supreme Court hears a tiny fraction of cases. 10 of the 13 federal courts of appeals at this point have a majority of judges who are appointed by presidents who are strong defenders of the environment. 10 out of the 13. And many of the remaining judges, they're not particularly partisan. They call the shots like a referee, despite what you hear in the press. So the courts are a very, very good place for us to be right now. They're better now than they were 8 years ago, 6 years ago, or even 2 years ago because of President Obama's appointees. I'm sorry, is that... The people in the front row are gonna cringe a little bit, but... so, as president cannot rule by fiat when he breaks the law. And we have every reason to think that he's going to violate environmental regulations, environmental statutes. We'll be in court to defeat him. That's number one cause for hope. Okay. The second cause for hope is that the economy is on our side. Adam Smith is on our side. A lot of what we need to do is come up with a clean energy economy, and that's happening on its own, with or without the government. The cost of solar energy has fallen by 80% since 2008. The cost of LEDs has fallen by 90% in that same time frame. The cost of batteries have fallen by 80%. It's now cheaper to have a clean future than to have a dirty future. And there's not much any president can do about that. The reason that there's not many coal jobs anymore isn't because there's been a war on coal. It's because coal is not economical anymore. And that's not going to change. And that's a cause for hope. Third cause for hope is that we live in a state, like a number of other states, that's a leader on the environment, and it's going to retain that position. I think by some estimates, California is the sixth largest economy in the world. California now has a law that provides for us to reduce our carbon pollution 40% below 1990 levels within the next 14 years. And that's an achievable target. A fifth of all Americans live in a state that have laws that require them to develop 50% of their electricity through renewables. That's really staggering, through solar and wind and similar renewable energy. And the states are going to be a bedrock of protection for the environment, and that's a cause for hope as well. So, Americans did not vote against the environment. They may not have voted as much as we would have liked for the environment, but that's the task ahead for us. We need to reach people where they are and show them that when we're protecting their communities from lead in their drinking water, or we're protecting the parks that they enjoy, we're fighting for them. And I'm convinced they're going to see that, and so in the end we'll prevail. Thank you.
Terrific. We are going to launch right into the conversation part of the evening, and I want to begin by asking our county supervisors, who are down here in the front row, to be our first speakers. We're going to give them a couple minutes to just update us on what's going on at the county level. One of my goals for this evening, by the way, is that everybody who came here wanting to take away some homework, wanting to take away something that they can sign up for, support, do, that you have some ideas and maybe even some real concrete solutions that meet your particular needs. In fact, I think that there's a handout that should be on every chair that lists some things that I hope will, Bill and Tamara and Bill down here in the front have done that for us. So we're just going to keep going, but hopefully light bulbs are going off in your heads already. And let's hear what's going on at the county level. Here's Damon Connell.
Person to have on the front lines in Washington, D.C. for us and Congressman Jared Huff. And what I heard Jared say this morning at another town hall is that, in fact, we're all on the front lines with him as Californians and also as residents of Marin County. I think we can be proud of our environmental ethos in Marin. I think now's the time for us to stand up and earn that reputation now, am I right? Let's do it. So our local efforts are structured around our climate action plan. which we finalized late last year, and it has two broad goals. One is to deal with the issue of sea level rise and adaptation. And in a minute, I'm going to have my colleague, Supervisor Kate Sears, come up and briefly talk about that. The other piece are local mitigation measures that we can all take in our own lives around food and agriculture, around waste, and around our energy consumption. There we're looking at two things. How is we, as local governments, can we actually reduce our own footprint? Just as importantly, or perhaps more importantly, how is we, as community members, going forward, reduce our own individual footprints? We have an ambitious goal. We want to reduce emissions by 30% below 1990 levels by 2020. Can we achieve that goal together? You better believe it. But now's the time to start. So it's going to involve all of us. What I'll conclude by saying is we're going to build into our program community engagement. We want to hear from all of you. And as we go forward with our implementation plan, we're going to have quarterly public meetings. The first one will be this spring. We'll get word out. We want to see you there. And as we go forward in reducing our impact on climate, as we continue to preserve our wetlands, have clean water, and otherwise protect our environment and our habitats in Marin County, I very much look forward to working with Congressman Hudman. Thank you.
Terrific. Supervisor Kate Sears.
So good evening, and thank you everyone for being here. So this Christmas, the gift that I am giving my family members are significant contributions to Earth Justice and NRDC that support their environmental life. Thank you for being here. I'm going to be So there are three things that I think are really important for all of us going forward out of this election. And the first is for all of us to really have our congressman's back for the very difficult work that he needs to do on our behalf and on behalf of the environment in Washington. We need to remember that. He is our lead and we need to support him. The second, we're all here because we love and we care about our environment. Coming out of this election, that's only one of several very important issues that are tremendous unifying factors for all of us in this room and in our community more broadly. Civil rights, health care, equity issues, we are really all in this together, and this is an opportunity to have the kind of collaboration across those different interest groups that we have not seen before. Dana Conley and I were at a green infrastructure conference in San Francisco last week, and one of the things that was most impressive about the people in that room was the unification of people who cared about housing, who cared about civil rights, who cared about equity, and who cared about the environment, all working together. The third thing that is crucial for all of us is to double down on the really great work that we have been doing here locally. And I just want to talk to you about a couple of things. We've been doing a lot of great work, and we're going to continue doing that work, and we're going to do even more of it. So let me give you the example of MCE Clean Energy. MCE currently has 24 contracts, 24 renewable energy projects under contract. 14 of those are located within 100 miles of MCE's service territory here in around the Bay Area, and another 10 are in California. Those are 24 solar, biogas, small hydro, geothermal, and wind projects that are going to make a tremendous difference in terms of creating renewable energy for our community and for our state. We do that without the federal government, and we can do more of it. The second thing that we're doing here that I know many of you in this room are engaged in and want all of you to know about is the incredible collaboration we have going between the county and all of our cities and towns in the county of Marin on sea level rise vulnerability assessment. This is a really important collaboration. Water goes everywhere, as you know. We need to break down the jurisdictional divides because working together is what makes us strong. So we've spent 2016 really focusing on the vulnerability assessment for our county. We're going to get that's going to be coming out in the first quarter of 2017, and then we are going to turn to focusing on adaptation. This is where you make a difference, right here in our county, and it's working together, and it's making sure that everyone in this room continues to be engaged. So thank you for being here. I look forward to working together with everybody.
Thanks, Supervisor. All right. We're going to dive into our questions, Ann, and I have a bunch already that we're going to get to. As we're starting with the ones that have come through on the comment cards, if there are folks who want to step to the microphone and get in line for the questions we'll be able to take in that manner, go ahead and do that. But we have no shortage of questions here, folks, so we're just going to get as far as we can. All right, the first question notes that Michael Bloomberg recently said that if Trump walks away from the Paris Accord, he'll ask mayors from 128 cities to sign on. Grassroots are great, but this question asks about California's contributions to the federal government that we pay, where we're a net contributor to the federal budget, of course, through our tax revenues. How are we going to get our money back? And is this something that we can do through a grassroots effort? So, look, I don't think we're going to get our money back. However, I do think this question and the role of cities and the state of California, and one could go on and list also local government and the business community and nonprofits and the faith community. Look, there's all this action and momentum that is moving forward and is not waiting for the United States Congress or for the next president of the United States to get their act together on these things. And that is going to continue, regardless of President Trump, regardless of the next Congress. So this subnational level of energy and action is a huge response to the challenges that we face. And I think Mayor Bloomberg is absolutely right. The cities can play a greater leadership role than they ever have before on a policy that is obviously of global significance. I think the business community can do that too. Obviously the nonprofit community. All of these folks, by the way, were in Paris, and many of them actually brought actions and commitments to the Paris Climate Agreement. It's one of the unique things about the Paris Accord is that it doesn't just have heads of state signing a bunch of promises for their countries. It has a whole bunch of Fortune 500 companies. It has a whole bunch of provincial and local governments that showed up to make commitments and more. And that is going to be a critical area of focus to maintain momentum. Any other thoughts?
I can just add. The institutionalizing of that is the under two MOU. How many people have heard? This was started by Governor Brown in California. There are now more than 200 states and provinces and major cities who have signed on to this subnational accord. So it's trying to take all of the great work that Congressman Huffman talked about and put a framework around it. They're raising money now to actually staff the effort. So again, Google the under two MOU and you'll see all the progress that's being made and places we can all join in.
Terrific. Next question. How do you fight the climate deniers on a level playing field when they do not use facts on their side? Climate change man-made versus climate change myth, and also the issue of oil and gas company big money, which is a real reason for the climate denial. We are sort of living in a post-factual political world these days, and it's more than just climate change. I mean, with the fake news, with the alternative reality that Donald Trump seems to live in on just about every other issue these days, including Russia's involvement in our election. We've got our work cut out for us. But it seems to me, and I want to hear from the others on this too, that part of the challenge is to urge people to do more of their own fact-checking and to be responsible consumers of information. There's just so much junk out there. And so many of these things are easily debunked. There are sites out there that you could point people to. You could also spend the rest of your life arguing with climate deniers. So you may want to decide how much energy you want to put into that particular effort, but the debate essentially is over in the scientific community. It's increasingly over with the American people. All the polls show that a majority of Americans have already crossed over into accepting the reality of man-made climate change. And really, I think my best advice is to try to always steer this thing back to what can we do about it, and why are those actions actually good for us? Because they really are. They're good for us economically, they're good for our quality of life, and more.
Two things. The first is that there may be climate deniers in the executive branch and leading Congress, but that is not the truth of the courts. The courts are a place where facts still matter. They matter a lot. The reason that President Obama had the power, or his EPA had the power to make the Clean Power Plan, was that the Supreme Court, with a majority of justices appointed by Republican presidents, found that climate change is real and that it's caused by carbon dioxide. And that was as a result of litigation we participated in. And you know, on remand, the president took that, his EPA took that power and enacted very sophisticated regulations that if they were adhered to, they're now in the DC Circuit, as Congressman Huffman mentioned, but if they were adhered to, it would make a tremendous difference for this country's contribution to climate change. So facts matter in the court. That's the first thing. And the second thing is, I just want to underscore, the American people get it. There's certainly climate deniers out there. It'll be interesting to see if the CEO of Exxon becomes your Secretary of State. What he did, does, Exxon is on record as supporting the Paris Climate Accords. People understand this. They see the storms, the droughts, the fires that are devastating, and they understand that the climate is changing. There may be pain about economic change, and people express that frustration in a lot of ways, but they get this, and I think we have won the battle. We have to adhere to our values, but we've won the battle about fact versus fiction on climate change with the majority of Americans.
I just want to disagree briefly. I think we're in trouble here. I think we underestimated this in the campaign, and I think making that mistake a second time would be a big mistake. I've been in the climate world for 12 years, and we've always had fake news. I mean, we pioneered fake news in the climate world. But I think the difference here now is social media. And The Guardian had a very good article the other day on the work that Breitbart and InfoWars and some of the other sites are doing to really beef up their climate work. They are going after eyeballs, and they are succeeding. The numbers are going up. So I would just caution. I've always been on the side of let's not even talk to the deniers. We've got enough of us to move forward. I'm starting to rethink that in terms of what happened with the election and what could be happening in terms of building more fake news on this issue. I don't have a solution, sorry. I'm not that smart and I'm not that young, but I think we need to get the young people thinking about this because they could come up with a better answer.